What number is this, Chip?
Episode 5, Monkey Magic and a Salute to Peter Tork.
Okay, no, I mean, like, don't get excited, man. It's because I'm short, I know.
You're listening to Zilch, a Monkeys podcast.
And welcome once again to your Monkeys monthly podcast, Zilch. Thank you for joining us once again, or if this is your first time. I am one of your hosts, Ken Mills, and we are joined today by another host, Craig Cohen. How are you doing, sir?
Hello, Ken. Hello, podcast listeners.
And we have with us a friend of the show, Mr. Matt Porter, who does The Kiss Room, which is a Kiss podcast, if you will. Welcome, Matt Porter, to Zilch.
Wow, it's awesome. This Zilch podcast headquarters is so spacious and different than, you know, our podcast recording studio. It's so nice. But the
do you like the spiral staircase?
I've really enjoyed listening to the Monkeys podcast. I mean, I'm a Monkeys fan. To hear you guys discuss the minutiae of the Monkeys, like, I sit there half time going, wow, like, I don't know, like, I love Kiss and that's my thing. So to hear that whole other dedication to this band, like, you guys know things like more about the Monkeys than I ever knew, and I really enjoy listening to it. It's a fantastic podcast.
Well, thank you so much. Bruce Kulick of Kiss is a huge Monkees fan, and you've had him on your show as well.
Absolutely.
So we'd like you to check out Matt's show, The Kiss Room. You can find it at podkist.com, and he also is on Monco Radio live once a month, and then we put it up again as its own standalone podcast.
What's the name of that other band, the one with the blood and the makeup? Kiss? No, thanks. You know, they have high heels and the guy has a 9-foot tongue. What is their name?
Kiss?
No, but Davey wants one.
Hopefully, Monkees fans, if you're Kiss fans, you know, you come join us. It's fun.
Yeah, the thing I like about the Kiss Room, Matt, is unlike other Kiss podcasts, it's just a really cool, loose discussion between Kiss fans, and it's something I look forward to every month.
But Matt is a huge Monkees fan as well. We've just invited him to help us go through the Monkees mailbag, and we're going to do that right now.
P.O. Box 9847.
And once again, we want to thank you so much for those iTunes ratings. Since Zilch has been unleashed on the world, wow, it's been in the top 10 all the time, and it's because of your ratings on iTunes. And if you rate us on iTunes, you get on the show. I'm going to start off, we're going to read a few of them, and then we'll get on to the rest of the episode. First one is from #StarChild. They say, I'm a believer. This cast is great. Stumbled upon this and on to Pods and Sods. So they're listening to Craig Smith's other podcast as well. Monkees versus the Banana Splits, Groovy Ghoulies 2. Definitely a child of the 60s and 70s. Craig Cohen, why don't you take the next one?
Sure. We have one from Rez Howski, and the headline is Zilch equals Much Monkey Mayhem. As many have said, about time. A great fun podcast for all Monkey fans. Great panel and great information. Even if you, like me, know most of the information given, it is great to hear it again from different viewpoints. Relive your past or enjoy your present. This podcast has something for every Monkey fan around.
Awesome. Thank you for that review. And a lot of people don't see it, but we can see Matt right now, and he's wearing a wool hat right now. So that's really cool. I'm glad you wore that just for this occasion. Would you like to read one?
Well, I'm also holding a pair of red miracles. No, really, I think it's fantastic you're getting such a good feedback. And this one is from Nick Namerson. And
hey,
he says,
Nick.
Listen to the fans. It's a 5-star rating. He says, the Monkees continue to evolve as a group of individual road-tested musicians with familiar personalities. Perhaps it is used to be the other way around, but those days are long gone. These days, the incredibly impressive Monkee songbook is presented by the 3 surviving members with a casual, seeming reference that both captures the group's original freewheeling spirit and allows for the passing of time along with the improbable era of the Gentleman Monkee. Zilch is hosted by a likable group of enthusiasts who know and appreciate the Monkees' story top to bottom, and I want to share it. Listen to the fans. That's cool.
That is awesome. And I'll get these last two. Great podcast from Tapioca Tundra. Gee, I wonder where they got that name from. Thank you for listening. They write with a 5-star review, "This is my favorite podcast on iTunes." Thank you, guys. So that's pretty good. The favorite podcast on iTunes. That's amazing. Wow. And I'd like to read this last one. It's from Mr. Jake Jacobs. "Just another reason why Ken Mills is the Podfather." And that's me. Gave us a 5-star rating and says, "I've been a fan of Ken Mills ever since I discovered his Kiss podcast, Podkissed, and now Zilch, a Monkees podcast," which you're listening to. "Ken is joined on this podcast by the very capable team of Craig Cohen." Hey, that's you. "Jeff Hewlett, Craig Smith, and Sarah Clark. If you're a Monkees or a Mills fan, you must subscribe to this at once. When my wife heard me read this review to her, she said, 'Your head is going to get even more swelled.' I won't be able to get through the door, you know, like when the Monkees are all going through a door together and they can't get through because they're all blocked, you know. Well, man, I want to thank you for stopping by Zilch headquarters and helping us kick off this episode.
Well, thanks for having me.
And now check out this very cool announcement from Then and Now Productions. Then and Now Events present the Brady Bunch Convention, August 15th, 16th, and 17th. Join the Bradys for the grooviest convention to hit the East Coast. Cast members from the TV show, the movie, specials, and more. The biggest Brady event ever. See Barry Williams, Johnny Bravo It Up live as he performs all the hits from the TV show. Not to be missed. At the Hilton Meadowlands, East Rutherford, New Jersey. August 15th, 16th, and 17th. For a complete list of guests and info, check out www.bradybunchconvention.com. And remember, have a sunshine day. Well, Craig, today we're going to do a kind of different kind of Zilch episode. We're going to do a spotlight on Peter Tork, and we're going to have Amy Gravino step in, and she's going to talk to me about the genius that is Peter Tork, from his comedic work in the show to his music as a solo performer and his work with the Monkees. Of course, we're going to be speaking to Melanie Mitchell, whose book
Monkees Magic,
a book about a TV show about a band, is something that you and I have been checking out, and we're going to be doing the commentary episode soon. Are you looking forward to that?
Oh, totally. And Melanie's book is a nice companion to have handy as we sit down and prepare for those episodes, which Melanie is going to be a part of. It's always good to get somebody's insight, so when you sit down to watch them, you can key in on those things. And the book's really, it breaks down every episode and offers lots of great info. So definitely a great companion piece to Zilch.
Well, let's listen to that interview now.
Hi, Zilch fans. This is Melanie Mitchell. Be sure to check out my book, Monkey Magic, a book about a TV show about a band. It's a lighthearted review and companion for the TV show that made the 60s fun. The paperback is available online from Amazon or Barnes & Noble, and the ebook can be bought anywhere that fine ebooks are sold. Check out the Monkey Magic Facebook page. Follow me on Tumblr at bluemoonalto.tumblr.com. And listen for my contributions here on Zilch, a Monkees podcast.
Well, Sarah, looks like we have someone on the Monkey line, on the Zilch line, someone that's pretty cool. We have author Melanie Mitchell, author of the great book Monkey Magic, a book about a TV show about a band. It's a pretty long title there, Melanie. I like it, though. How are you today? Welcome to Zilch.
Why, thank you so much. I'm so excited to do this. I've been listening to Zilch since episode zero, and I just love it.
Yeah, that whole episode zero kind of messed everybody up, because they'll go, "I'm listening to the third episode, which is actually the fourth or the second. I'm not quite sure." So anyway, it all works out. Let me ask you about your personal Monkees history, and then we're going to get in and talk about your book, Monkey Magic, a book about a TV show about a band. So tell us a little bit about your Monkees history. How did you become a Monkees fan, and when did they come on your radar?
My Monkees history is extremely short. I was just barely too young to see the show back in the 60s, and I didn't have an older sibling to introduce me to it, and my parents would not have let me choose the channel on our one TV show. So I don't think I ever saw it in the 60s. I saw it once in a while as a child, as a teenager, but I never really got into it. And when the show came, exploded again in 1986, I was in my mid-20s and did not have cable. And so I never saw it on MTV. I never saw it on Nickelodeon. The Monkees were part of my cultural soup that I grew up in, but it was not a significant part of my life until the day David Jones died. I heard about it on the radio. I didn't really understand what the big hoopla was, but I was certainly aware of the hoopla. All of the obituaries and interviews and documentaries and in memoria, it was all over the news. It was all over the magazines and the newspapers. And I decided to get online and see what it was that everyone was so upset about. And I fell down the internet monkey hole. I have been falling ever since. I hope I never reach the bottom because I am having so much fun.
Wow. Well, you know, there are some people that think that in order to be a real Monkey fan, you have to have been there from the beginning or at least have caught it in the 80s and at least. But I'm telling you, every day a Monkey fan is being born somewhere. And Stan Lee, the guy behind Marvel Comics, one of the people behind Marvel Comics, he always said you have to make every comic book that comes out accessible to whoever's picking it up, meaning that, yes, you know, you might not know the last 5 years of history, but you should be able to jump in at this point. And Davy's death rocked the Monkees community, and it woke a lot of people up. And I'm just glad that you're here and part of it all. So
I do have a strong sense of regret that I did miss so much, and I'm intensely grateful to all of the people who archived all of the things that happened in the last 45 years so that I can see video of a concert that took place 15 or 20, 25 years ago. And I can see interviews that took place over the years and read teen magazines from 1967. People are so dedicated about putting that material out there, and it's a very important resource for me. And I'm also very indebted to the other authors who have chronicled the whole Monkees phenomenon. So it really does make it easier for me. Personally, because I had seen a little bit of the show when I was a child, when I came back to it in my 50s, I had a sort of triple lens, because I was seeing it partly through the lens of the little 7-year-old who probably saw it on Saturday mornings once in a while. And there are certain elements in the show that resonate with me as a child. And then other elements of the show that resonate with me as a teenager. I saw the show once in a while as a teen. That would be late 70s. And then other things that I'm seeing as a mature adult. But that's part of the reason that I called the book Monkey Magic, was because in my internal classification system for television shows, I had classified the Monkees in the same category with Bewitched and I Dream of Jeannie. As a child watching this show, what I saw were four fun-loving musicians who had magical powers.
Because basically they could affect what was going on around them.
Well, there's magic in almost every episode. But what was so wonderful about it was that they never talked about it. And on Bewitched and I Dream of Jeannie and other shows in that sort of genre, like The Ghost of Mrs. Muir, it was all about rules. It was about who had magic, who didn't have magic, how the magic worked, and why we have to keep this all a secret. The Monkees didn't bother with any of that. If they needed something, they'd conjure it out of thin air. If they needed a costume, it would appear.
For example, the Monkey Men costume.
Yes. Exactly. And they would transform right out in public, and it would be no big deal. The FBI agents in Monkey Chow Maine don't blink an eye.
Exactly.
They're the two guys in the long johns.
Yep. Very true. And it seems like it's almost passive, like they're not even aware of it, in a sense.
I said in my book, it's as easy as breathing and as fun as singing.
Yeah, exactly. When you think about it, it kind of goes back to the Marx Brothers or another person or another character that we all love, Bugs Bunny.
I thought we were going there. Yes, that is exactly what I was thinking.
I mean, Bugs Bunny could become someone in drag, or he'd have a little Mexican maracas, and, you know, he'd be singing a song to Elmer Fudd and dancing on his gun. Next thing you know, he's a police officer. So in that same bit of anarchy and in that same aspect, that's what Monkey's Magic is.
Now, I do want to emphasize to anyone who's listening to this that the book is not purely about the magical aspect
of
the
show.
I used it as a metaphor for whimsy and unpredictability, but my inner 7-year-old is quite pleased.
Even though you're saying that you came into this at a later stage of your life, and you were saying that your inner 7-year-old and the person that saw this back at the time, how they look at it and how you did as a teenager, I'm telling you that as somebody that was a little kid when these shows first aired, I'm in the same boat as you. So it doesn't matter where we came into monkey fandom or how we got here, it's all the same.
I will tell you that one person I exchanged these thoughts with messaged back to me and said, "You do realize that was just camera tricks, right?" And I was like, "You mean unlike Bewitched?"
Yes, yes, or Star Trek or anything, you know.
How did you go from learning about the monkeys and sort of going down the rabbit hole to suddenly deciding, "I'm going to watch every single episode of the monkeys and write reviews of them"?
Well, first of all, I fell down the monkey hole in early March 2012, and it wasn't until May 17th that I got the first set of DVDs. And I know that because it was my birthday, and I had told members of my family how excited I was about the monkeys and sat back and waited for them to give me the DVDs for my birthday. And they didn't. I did get an Amazon gift card, so I went straight home and bought them for myself. And I watched them greedily. I mean, I zipped through them as fast as I could. I was so excited. I'd watched a few of the episodes online, but it's not the same. I was so excited to have the commentary track. I remember feeling, you know, in some cases, oh, I've seen that before. And in some cases, I've never seen this before. This is totally new. And so I watched them over and over and over again. And then I decided that if I was going to get involved in the fandom and meet some people and start some conversations, I needed something to contribute. Watch what other people were doing on Tumblr. And a lot of them had pictures and animated pictures and song clips and stories. But no one was really talking about the TV show much. But I'd written episode reviews of other TV shows before. And it's something I enjoy doing. So I said, okay, well, I'm going to start writing these and see if it's something I can sustain. So I started with Alias Mickey Dolenz, and I wrote about 10 in a row and thought, yeah, I can keep this going. So I opened up a Tumblr account and posted the first one to empty air.
And it all started there.
It all started there, but it started out as a blog. I had no intention of writing a book. I never dreamed of writing a book. I just wanted to talk to somebody. And so that's where it started.
Melanie, on the first episode of Zilch, we talked about the concept of, are the monkeys a TV show or are they a band? So what is your take on that question?
At the beginning of the introduction, you commented on how long the title of my book is. And the second half of the title is a book about a TV show about a band. And that's sort of a paraphrase of something that Mickey Dolenz often says in interviews. When somebody says to him, you know, tell us about the monkeys, and he says, well, the thing you have to remember is the monkeys was not a band. The monkeys was a TV show about a band. And I used to hear him say that and think, oh, what a shame. He's making excuses and he's trying to downplay the band and what they contributed. And it took a long time before I heard him say that and suddenly hear it the other way around. He wasn't dismissing the music or making excuses for the music. He was bragging about the TV show because that was the product. The TV show was what they were there to do.
Right.
The music was the sideline. So that's my answer to your question.
And it's weird because they both fed off of one another and promoted one another. So It really is a bit of genius, whoever came up with that concept. It's just fantastic.
Oh, yeah. It was a cycle. I mean, the music on the radio drove the kids to the record stores. The record sales helped promote the TV show, and the TV show helped promote the record sales. It was a cycle. I wanted to say vicious cycle, but it wasn't anything vicious about it. Mm-hmm. It was a multimedia genius. But the television show was the core product. Peter Tork has said, if we'd had the records but no TV show, we would have had nothing.
Right. Absolutely. So, Melanie, I know that you've written the book about the TV show, but I got to ask, do you have like a favorite song or one of the favorite songs that you love hearing live?
I love hearing and I love singing Pleasant Valley Sunday.
Well, let's check out a version of them doing that. It's often said that you can't judge a book by its cover, but you have a really cool cover on this book. Could you tell us about the artist and how you got to come up with this concept?
I would love to. Her name, the artist's name is Jamie Hitchcock, and I met her through Tumblr. Mm-hmm. She frequently posts cartoon images of the monkeys and various other things. And I just fell in love with one of the drawings that she did, I think it was back in late 2012. It was a group picture of the four monkeys, and she had Mike standing in the middle, dressed in that sharp blue suit with the ruffly shirt and the ruffly collars. Mm-hmm. And he was posed like Mr. Danger Man. He was holding a sonic screwdriver. And the caption, of course, was Dr. Nez.
Yeah.
Nez is Doctor Who, and the other three were sort of clustered behind him looking terrified. And I loved that picture so much, and that's when I decided I wanted her to do my cover picture. So I asked her to pose the four of them together. The original concept was that they would be facing something that might be just a little bit scary. Later, I sort of backed down on that, and but she does have Mike looking very skeptical, and Davey's got his fists up, which I love. Because
well, he always wanted to give the Manchester kiss to people, so...
Well, he was the one monkey who was most likely to punch somebody. I mean, not speaking as him as a person, but as a character. And that's something I'd like to say, is that in my book, I'm always very careful to differentiate between the characters and the actors.
Right.
What I did was I decided, rather than constantly being saying the fictional Peter or the real-life Mike, I would always refer to the characters by their first name. So whenever I use a first name, I'm talking about a fictional person. Whenever I use a last name, I'm talking about a real-life flesh-and-blood actor. So it would be perfectly logical for me to say, Dolenz was magnificent in this episode. Mickey was a fumbling, bumbling, stumbling ball of insecurity.
So you've got the dynamic of those two different ways of looking at the show. And,
That's but getting back to Jamie, she did a wonderful job with this picture. I love it to death. And I just wish I could have filled the whole book with illustrations. And that is a comment I've gotten from a few readers, is there's no pictures. And the answer is quite simply, I couldn't afford them.
Right.
I couldn't afford to pay for the copyright and all the layout issues. So it's just the cover image. But I figure my readers either can queue up their DVDs or just close their eyes and picture it in their heads.
When people open this book up, or if you're reading it on Kindle, and that's personally how I have it, is the Kindle version. And lately I've been watching the shows, and it's really neat because you can just, you know, like it's got a little table of contents, and I pop the little thing open and it tells me what I should look out for in the shows. And not only do you have a breakdown of what happens in each episode, but you have a little bit about the cast and your personal take and thoughts on the show. Just a few other things. Can you kind of go into what makes a chapter of your book? Kind of let folks know what they get when they get this book.
Well, actually, the easiest thing for me to tell you is what my book is not.
Okay.
The first thing my book is not is a recap. I do not recap the episode. I figure my readers have seen the episodes probably 100 times, or at least 10, but they don't need me to tell them that Mr. Zero is really the devil. Spoiler alert!
Right.
The other thing my book is not is a history of how the show was made.
Right.
I don't talk about the auditions. I don't talk about the struggle for control of the music. There are other books out there that cover that perfectly well. I didn't need to say that again, and I wasn't there, and I'm not an expert. So basically what I'm talking about is what actually made it onto the screen. There's a chapter for each episode, chapter for Head, a chapter for each of the two TV specials. And I start with an essay, that I call it a review. Sometimes I'll talk about something like plot structure or theme or character development or continuity. Sometimes I'll compare one episode to another that had similar themes or similar stories. I'll point out things that really worked well, things that maybe didn't work so well, and then I move into a listing of highlights and lowlights. Good dialogue, sight gags. I do mention breaking the fourth wall. I do some nitpicking. Give the songs that are included in each episode and how they were used. And mention the writers, the director, the filming date, the air dates. And then I just give it some letter grades that are completely meaningless and totally frivolous. Oh, and I always give a snack or a beverage to enjoy while watching.
If you've got a reader who has maybe not seen every single episode, but is like, oh my gosh, I loved Monty Landis as Mr. Zero. Is he in any other episodes? Is there a section of the book where you can find out where basically everywhere Monty Landis appeared in the series? Because there were several.
Actually, there were seven, and they were all filmed within a space of 8 weeks in the spring of 1967. But you weren't asking that specifically. I do have an index of actors who appeared in more than one episode in the back of the book. And also throughout the book, there's a feature in each episode review which has the title, pardon me, We're the Young Generation and We've Got Something to Recycle, where I talk about running gags, reused plot elements, reused props, like the throne from Royal Flush that shows up like five or six times, including in the movie Head. also I mentioned if an actor in that episode appeared in a different episode, I mentioned what the context of that role was. And it's not just somebody as prominent as Monty Landis. I mean, there are some that are quite obscure that I never even noticed until it was pointed out to me. For example, the actor who plays Kimba, Tarzan of the Jungle kind of character in Monkeys Marooned, also appeared in the Christmas episode as the butler.
Ah.
Same actor. I think his name is Bert Mustin.
Yeah. Well, it's really cool when you're reading the book, because that's something that I use quite a bit, because I every once in a while I'll go like, but that woman was this and this other one and so on and so forth, and it really helps me out a lot.
There's an actress named Bonnie J. Dewberry who appeared in the show twice, and she wasn't credited either time. She was the doctor's beautiful daughter in I Was a Teenage Monster, and she was also Cousin Lucy in Monkeys in Texas.
Ah.
She didn't get a credit for either role. I was very indebted to Aaron Handy's website, the Monkeys Film and TV Vault, for information like that.
Excellent. But it's definitely something that I enjoy about the book. It's very cool. God help you, you had to document 33 and a third, so...
I wasn't as bad as Monkey's Race Again.
Yeah, that's... Well, ouch. You got me on that one. do you have a favorite episode?
Well, you know, a while back somebody asked me that, and I made it to some comment about, no, I have a range of episodes that I like, you know, for different reasons. And then I realized that in my book I actually say that The Devil and Peter Tork stands unchallenged as my favorite episode.
Ah.
So apparently I've changed my opinion. So that would be one of them. But if I want to laugh, I really, really love Hillbilly Honeymoon.
Ah, that's a good
one. It is so funny. The dialogue is so funny. And it's got a really intricate plot with the different characters interacting in different groups.
Yeah.
So you start out with Peter at one house and the three at the other house, and then two go to the house and then Davy goes back, and then, you know, it's this constant switching back and forth between who's at which house and which set of characters they're interacting with.
Absolutely. Sarah, do you have a favorite Monkees episode?
I have two. I have the best Monkees episode and my favorite Monkees episode.
Ah, so I see what you did there.
Yes. The best Monkees episode, in my opinion, as far as best acting, best script, best directing, all of that, Devil and Peter Tork, no question. I mean, Hillbilly Honeymoon's good. There are several others that are great. But Devil and Peter Tork just takes it to a whole nother level for me. As far as my favorite episode, the one I always pop in when I want to laugh, this is actually the first Monkees episode I ever saw, Fairy Tale.
Ah, yeah, that's a
classic.
And
by the time Princess Gwen was honoring Peter's spine, I was a fan for life. So there you go.
And, you know, that's one of the ones I missed. I never saw it until I was in my 50s.
Really? What kind of response have you gotten from the book?
I've had a lot of really kind words and a lot of people that have told me they enjoyed it. Of course, people who speak to me in person usually say nice things. And
Welcome to the internet.
I think the criticism that I get occasionally, other than the fact that there are no pictures, is that I criticize episodes that they like.
Ah.
And I get but how could you say something mean about Name the Episode? And my book is a book of opinion. I give my opinions, and,
right.
and I'm quite frank about my opinions. I don't expect people to agree with me, but I just... starting this as a place to start a conversation. You know, think about this element and then tell me I'm wrong and we'll talk about it.
Right. Well, that makes sense. But you're never really down on any episode. You're actually...
I'm down on a few.
Really? Which ones? Which ones? Okay. We've talked about your favorites. What are your least favorite Monkey episodes?
Well, I'll give you two. One is the episode that I think is the worst, and then the other is the episode that I gave a failing grade to. And they're not the same thing. The episode that I think is the worst is Monkey's Race Again. The auto racing Nazis episode. And it's just awful. And it was the very last episode made.
Ah.
A lot of people think of Mija Kojo or the Frodo's Caper as the last one. But actually, Monkey's Race Again was the last one filmed.
Mm.
So you can sort of get the idea that maybe their hearts just were not in it. They finished just a few days before Christmas, 1967, and then pulled the plug.
Wow.
And the only thing they did after that, there was one day of filming after they wrapped on Monkey's Race Again, And that's when they did the wraparound scenes for Monkeys in Paris, where the guys interrupt filming to say how disgusted they are.
Yeah.
And then stomp off the set. That was actually done after Monkeys Race Again, and that was the last thing they filmed before they shut the TV show down forever.
When the world and I were young just yesterday, life was such an easy game, a child could play. It was easier to tell right from wrong, easier to tell me from strong, when a man should stand and run, or just go along. But today there is no day or night, today there is no tug or fight.
Actually a very high quality episode, but I had to flunk it on a technicality.
Okay.
I dreaded writing the review for that episode so much that I accidentally skipped right past it and had to come back and do it after, out of sequence. I wrote the episode reviews in alphabetical order, and when I had alphabetized the list of episode titles, I had misspelled that particular episode so that it came up in the wrong place in the alphabetical order. I was dreading it. I'm keeping you in suspense. It's fun.
Drum roll.
The episode is Monkey Chow Mein.
Now, I watched that last night.
It's a great episode.
Okay.
I wanted to say nice things about it. I did say nice things about it.
Uh-huh.
The Monkey Men sequence is excellent. The character development, that whole scene when they're getting ready for bed, and Mike's securing the door, and Peter... comes out of the bathroom and he's scared.
But they don't lock the door with the windows. Without windows, by the way.
He forgot to lock the patio door, and that's where the kidnappers came in.
Yeah.
But I had to flunk it on a technicality, because the more I watched it, the more uncomfortable I was with the racist aspects of the episode.
Now, my stepson and I were watching that, and we're like, there's no way that this would fly today, you know. that, you know,
I tried that excuse. I thought, well, you know, it was 1967. They didn't know any better. That was considered acceptable at the time. And then I thought, well, what if it had been about African spies?
Ouch.
With white actors in blackface, wearing loincloths and spears and drums, you know, it would have been. And that's what tipped it for me. Mm-hmm. And I said, it's intolerably racist. Unlike other episodes that were about fictional places like Nahuti or the Duchess of Harmonica, this was about a specific country. Long pigtails and the gongs and, you know, it just, I had to give it a failing grade. And I do talk in my review about what was good about that episode, but then I give it a failing grade anyway.
Well, see, to me, it goes back to, like, what we were talking about Bugs Bunny. It's a thing of its time to me. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I laughed my ass off, so that's all I need out of it.
And see, that's a valid interpretation, too. And it's like, I can see both sides, because Monkey Chow Mein was probably a top five episode for me till very recently. Because when I was a kid, I loved it. I was into China, so I thought it was just the most awesome thing ever. And I mean, I grew up in Oklahoma, so what do I know from these things?
Right.
It has some of the best moments in the series, but overall it definitely has some unfortunate implications going on.
My least favorite part is the cook the monkey with the cookie, cook the monkey
cookie.
It's like, that joke is getting old fast. That's to me the only part that I can't forgive is when you waste my time so with the monkey, you know. Other than that, I'm cool with the whole show. It just made me laugh, and like I said, that's laugh-o-meter works for me.
Yeah, and I don't want people to think that I just give it an F and then move on. I mean,
no.
Write in,
there's love there
about what is good. Actually, one of my favorite moments in that episode is actually quite profound,
and that is
monkeys are originally threatened with kidnapping. Mike says, well, I don't know, Orientals are very curious people.
Yeah.
And that sort of made me cringe.
But then he says, and Occidentals. Then,
seconds later, when the CIS agents threaten them, he says, well, Occidentals are a curious people. And when you take those two together, the original meaning of Oriental was just east.
Yeah.
And Occidental is west. So when you put those together, he's basically saying that all of humanity is a curious people. And that's rather profound. So I compliment that in my review. But I still gave the episode an F. Mind you, the grades don't mean anything.
Whose line is it anyway? Right.
Exactly.
Grades, I sometimes, you know, I just toss a coin at the end to choose the actual letter grades.
Melanie, also on this episode of Zilch, we're going to explore and discuss a little bit of Peter Tork's solo career. And I'd like to ask you a few questions, like, what do you think of Peter Tork as an actor/comedian?
I think he doesn't get quite as much credit for his acting as he deserves.
Uh-huh.
A lot of times people will say that the TV show was made with two actors and two musicians, and that those were mutually exclusive. The truth is that all four of them had skills in both areas. Before Peter ever moved to California, he was performing alone in coffee shops in Greenwich Village. He was having to, you know, keep his audience engaged enough that they would put some coins in his banjo at the end of his set, because that's the only pay he got.
Right.
People who have described his work in Greenwich Village have said that he told stories and told jokes. And in fact, he created the character that he used on the Monkees TV show in New York as part of that act. He said that if a joke fell flat, he would put on that character and behave like he didn't understand why people didn't think the joke was funny. They told him it was funny, and he thought it was, you know, supposed to be funny. So he carried that character with him to the auditions, and according to Peter, that's a big part of what got him the job, was that character. That he had it ready to go, and they said, you know, you can have the part, but we want you to play that character. And Mickey, in his autobiography, said that Peter had the toughest acting job of the four of them, because he was not playing himself. He was playing somebody else.
The other guys were basically playing exaggerated versions
of their own personalities, And Mickey says that, and I think most people would agree, that Peter character was nothing like the real Peter.
Mm-hmm. And I always found it interesting that he could play the sweetness and the somberness as well as the goofiness and the craziness.
Yeah, there are some variations. One of the very early episodes to be made, we see a flash of some real sour sarcasm,
yeah,
which really kind of surprised me. But most of the time, you know, he'd just loosen all the facial muscles and widen his eyes, and he would just look so sweet and innocent and young and harmless.
I've always liked in Monkeys on the Wheel where he imitates Davy, where he does that part where he says, "You must be joking."
And then he doesn't understand why Davy's offended.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
Yeah, he continues on with it. I'm going to play that right now.
You must be joking.
That's my line.
I'm sorry.
You must be joking.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah.
Also, in the very first episode, which is the Royal Flush, there's no duh, they do an interview segment at the end of that episode.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the questions is, you know, what did you think of the episode? And Peter says, well, it could have been better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, what do you mean? Well, that sword fighting scene, I could have done that better.
Yeah. And sadly, in the recording studio, he never really got his just desserts or props. But
certainly not in the first couple
right.
of albums.
So what did you think of Peter Tork as a solo artist?
To be honest, I'm kicking myself that I came to this fandom so late, because I never got a chance to hear some of his previous activities. The two-man band that he did with James Lee Stanley, I've heard a couple of their albums, and it's just ethereal music. I love it so much. But I do go to see Shoe Suede Blues as often as I can. That's his blues band. And he did a solo tour last year that I saw three times, that solo show that was a lot of fun. And it was all acoustic, acoustic guitar and banjo, and he told stories. It was wonderful.
Now, we're going to be doing something here on Zilch, your Monkees podcast, where we're going to do scene-by-scene specific commentary for each and every episode of the Monkees. So you'll be able to watch along and play along with us. So are you excited about that?
Oh, God, I'm thrilled. That was, when I heard about that, that was what won me over to the Zilch podcast right away. I was posting about it on Tumblr saying, oh, my God, there's this podcast. They're going to do episodes. Yay! Because that's what I originally set out to do, was to talk about the TV show and get into conversations.
Yeah, it's going to be a little cross between Mystery Science Theater 3000, actual commentary. So we're going to have some fun. And you know, just that's what we're all here for. So
I'm so excited.
How did your blog, which I followed from fairly early on, how did your blog reviews become a book?
I never intended to write a book, but I was about halfway through posting my episode reviews when I got a note from a fellow named Andrew Hickey. Andrew Hickey has written a book called Monkey Music, and He's also written books about the Beatles and the Beach Boys.
Right.
And he's currently working on a book about the whole Los Angeles music scene in the 1960s. And it was he who suggested that I turn my blog into a book. And he told me about self-publishing and warned me that I wouldn't make any money at it, but I might have fun. And he was right. Once he planted that idea, I realized that if I didn't at least try, I would never know if I could have done it. And so I decided to do it. I made it a New Year's resolution at New Year's Day 2013, that 2013 would be the year of the book. And the book was published in late December, so I managed to do it, and I managed to do it in the year. So I owe a great deal to Andrew Hickey for pushing me in that direction. I never would have thought of doing it myself.
Well, we want to encourage everybody to pick up your book and tell us where folks can find you on the internets.
My Tumblr account is Blue Moon Alto. Mm-hmm. That's Blue Moon Alto bluemoonalto.tumblr.com. I have a Facebook page that you can link to through the Zilch page.
People can check out your Facebook page about the book at facebook.com/groups/monkeymagic. So folks can check out all things about the book Monkey Magic.
It's available on Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, or anywhere fine ebooks are sold.
You have a few books that you're going to sell and autograph. And
certainly,
basically, for almost the same price as you pay on Amazon, it's going to cover shipping and stuff like that. But you're going to get an autographed book from you.
I'm asking for $15 for the book and $5 to cover postage and a box. Postage goes to the Postal Service, and the rest of it goes to the local store where I buy the box, but $15, which is the cost of the book itself, goes to the Davy Jones Equine Memorial Fund.
So if you'd like to pick this book up, check our Facebook pages and Melanie's Facebook group for Monkey Magic and get the details there. And I think it's definitely neat to get it signed because you can't get it signed from Amazon and stuff like that. So this is a good opportunity for some folks. And we encourage folks to help out. If they want to help out Davy's cause, please, this is one way. Well, we also look forward to you being on the commentary episode that we're going to be doing, and this is going to be fun.
I'm so excited.
We are too.
I can't wait.
Thank you, Melanie.
Thank you.
All right, God bless. Joining us on the Zilch Hotline is the lovely Miss Amy Gravino. How are you doing, dear?
I'm great, thank you. Thank you for having me back, Ken.
The last time you were on our show, it was prior to going to Beavertown for the Davy Jones Memorial, so glad to have you back here. Today we're kind of doing a little focus on Peter Tork.
Peter Halston Torkelson was born on February 13, 1942 in Washington, D.C. His parents were John and Virginia Torkelson. Peter briefly attended Carleton College in Minnesota, but music, not academics, was clearly what turned him on. In 1963, 21-year-old Tork went to Greenwich Village, a hip New York City enclave of artists and offbeat characters. In 1965, after 2 years playing banjo and guitar in Greenwich Village clubs, Tork headed west to Los Angeles.
He always seems to be the monkey that gets the short end of the stick. And I was talking to Melanie Mitchell about you, and she told me a story about you, and I thought it was so sweet. And, you know, I could have had 100 different Peter Tork experts on, but I wanted someone that really cared for Peter Tork, the guy, the musician, and, you know, the person. I found out that you took cookies to Peter Tork, and I thought, you know, if someone can take cookies to someone, that means that they must think pretty highly of them, because anyone that's ever given me cookies or people that really love me, like my grandmother, and things like that. So I just thought it was very sweet, and I thought that's the girl I want to talk about Peter Tork with.
Well, thank you. Well, it started actually, it wasn't intentional how it started, because I had made brownies for one of the shows I was going to see Peter and his band Shoe Suede Blues in 2009, and I brought them for this fan whom I met on Facebook, but she just had dental work done, so she couldn't eat the brownies, so I wound up feeding the brownies to the band. It just went from there. Every show that I went to after that, which turned out to be quite a few because they were touring in my area quite often, so I was able to go, I brought a new type of cookie every time, and I would feed Peter and the band the cookies, and that was how I kind of got to know them through that.
That is so cool. That is so cool. So what is it that you love about Peter Tork? What's some things that a monkey fan might be missing that's really not into Pete? What clue us in.
Well, he's, of course, he's a very gifted instrumentalist. That's kind of one of the things that jumped out at me when I first started going to the shows, was that he would effortlessly go from playing guitar to the keys to sometimes the banjo, and he would just be so great on every single one of them. And that versatility, I think, has always been underrated. You know, even Peter himself, he's often said how he wishes that he just knew how to play one or two instruments really, really well instead of 8 or 10 instruments, just mediocre. And I think mediocre isn't the nicest, you know, he's certainly not a mediocre player on any
Absolutely
of them.
Absolutely not.
So he's very versatile, and, you know, and in this band he takes on the lead vocals because he's the front man. And that's a very different task than when he was with the Monkees, where he was relegated mainly to backing vocals and very few, if any, leads. But with the blues songs, he's able to sing more in his own vocal range because he is a baritone. And I think with the Monkees music, he was often singing in a tenor range, and so it didn't sound so good. So with the blues songs, he's able to sing more in a range that's comfortable for him, and he sounds a lot better. And the band that backs him is so talented. I mean, that's a huge part of it too. He's picked guys who really know their stuff. Joe Boyle is his guitarist, and he is the most insane guitar player I've ever seen. His solos are just extraordinary. And then he has Arnold Jacks on bass guitar, and he's a terrific bass player. The drummer that I had first started seeing was Derek Lord. That was who was the drummer back in 2009. And Derek goes back to the 80s with Peter. He was on part of the Peter Tork Project. So they go a long way back. And Derek left the band, however, in the interim, and the new drummer is Sturgis Cunningham, and he's a terrific drummer as well. So the whole backing band really helps add to and enhance Peter's talents, and he's able to, you know, show off what he does. And it's so great to see him kind of get out of the Monkees box and flourish, you know, as this both an instrumentalist and a singer in his solo work.
Peter Tork and Shoe Suede Blues.
This song, I don't know who pointed it out to me, the Mills Brothers did it. It's, and you can tell when you hear the lyrics, it's a World War II song. It harked back to a time when the American forces thought that what they were fighting for was, you know, freedom and for all. Now American forces are basically fighting not to get swamped, and I don't know if anybody knows what the exact mission of the American forces overseas is, or missions are. But this was back to a simpler, happier time. After World War II came suburbs, houses, a thriving middle class, a strong union movement. So I'm going to do this to remind me of those days in hopes that it cheers me up. It's called Till Then, which will come as no surprise when you hear the lyric, which is just full of that line. Till then, my darling, please wait for me. Till then, no matter when it will be. Till then, when I can hold you again, please wait till then. Our dreams will live though we are apart. Our love I know we'll keep in our heart. Till then, when all the world will be free. Please wait for me. I know there are oceans we must cross and mountains we must climb. I know every gain must have its loss, so pray that our loss is nothing but time. Till then, we'll call on each memory. Till then, no matter when it will be. Till then, when I can hold you again, please wait till then. I know there are oceans we must cross and mountains we must climb. I know every gain must have its loss, so pray that our loss is nothing but time. Till then, we'll call on each memory. Till then, no matter when it will be. Till then, when I can hold you again, please wait. Till then, please wait. Till then.
What did you think of his work with James Lee Stanley?
Wonderful stuff. I had the pleasure. I finally got to see Peter perform with James Lee Stanley, but they did a special thing at the Town Crier in Pawling, New York, so I was able to go to that. And they're delightful together. I noticed that, you know, having seen, you know, Peter's solo shows and the shtick that he does, he stole about 93% of his shtick from James Lee Stanley, I would say. At this show, they each did their own set first, and then they performed together. Uh-huh. And watching James Lee, I thought, my God, I've heard all of this out of Peter's mouth before. He stole everything. So, but they're wonderful together. And James Lee Stanley is a wonderful human being and a hilarious man. And they're great together. I mean, I don't know how often they get to perform together these days. Not too often. But if anybody has a chance to see that, I think they definitely should.
Thank you.
went to the mountain, far as I could see. Some man got my woman, lonesome blues got me. But you better come home in my kitchen, because it's going to be raining outdoors.
What do you think of Peter's solo album in the 80s?
Stranger Things Have Happened is the album. I thought it was very interesting. I was so surprised. One of my favorite songs on there is Milkshake, and it's an absurd song in every sense of the word. Actually, Mickey and Nez do backing vocals on it, which it's an interesting album for sure. There's some songs, like he does another version of Getting In, which he had done with the Monkees, I believe, on Pull It.
Yeah.
And I much prefer the solo version because it doesn't have that 80s-ness to it. It doesn't have the crazy synthesizers and the...
Right.
It's a little more bearable. But
I actually like the 80s sounding, Pete. It has a new wave kind of sound. Like, he could be easily have worked in a new wave band.
True. I guess it's not to my personal taste, but definitely it has its own appeal, for sure.
Well, let's check out an acoustic version of Getting In.
I don't do this very often, this solo show.
You'll do fine.
I said, shut up! Think I want your encouragement?
Your heart, I'm getting into your mind.
why do you think it is that Pete gets the short end of the stick?
I remember reading a quote from Don Kirshner talking about when he was looking at each of their voices and trying to see who was going to be the lead singer or whatnot. And I remember he said, I thought Mickey had a great voice and Nesmith sounded like he was trying to be Hank Williams or something. And then he says about Peter, and I didn't think Peter had any voice at all. And I thought that was so hurtful. You know, and it's the kind of dismissal out of hand. I mean, of course, being a great vocalist is a wonderful thing. And Mickey Dolenz is one of the most amazing vocalists in, I think, pop music history. But Peter, and part of it might have also been because of the role he played on the TV show, being the dummy. You know, that was just a role. But a lot of people saw that as who he really was. People have a hard time separating the character from the person, especially when the character and the person have the same name.
Uh-huh.
And so I think that made it a little harder for Peter because he was kind of typecast as that, and he had to work twice as hard to be, I think, taken more seriously. Yeah, he wasn't, you know, as prolific a songwriter as Nez, for example. He wasn't the heartthrob like Davey, and he wasn't the supersonic vocalist like Mickey. So he was Peter, and right. And so his talents may not be the same as the other guys, but they're just as strong, just in a different way. And Peter himself has said that he is the most classically trained in that he went to school for it and he could read music and he could notate music. But, you know, even Mike Nesmith has said that he felt that Peter was a better musician than he by several orders of measure. Mike recognized Peter's talent, I think, from the beginning. I mean, he fought to have Peter play guitar on Papa Jean's Blues. He saw that, and that's a wonderful thing. And so I think Peter's always had musical talent. It's just, you know, for some people, they want something that's more tangible and accessible. Like if somebody's a great singer, oh, that's, you know, that's immediate. If somebody's a great lyricist, a great songwriter, oh, yeah, that I got the message of that, man. But, you know, when someone's a great instrumentalist, I think it's harder if you're not more into music and instruments and appreciating, you know, I don't know the first thing about guitar chords or about somebody hitting some stellar note that is really hard to hit. I have no clue. You know, when Peter goes into his guitar talk, it's pretty much lost on me right. A lot of the time. But you don't necessarily have to be a guitar expert to appreciate his talent as an instrumentalist right. at all. You know, so just being able to listen. I just remember the first time I saw him on keyboards doing the Bach two-part invention and the solfeggio.
Uh-huh.
And I was, all I could think was, any man who can do that with his fingers is a man that I want to know. And I just thought that he was just tremendous, just tremendous and amazing. And I've always been blown away by him on that, and on banjo in particular. So I think he's wonderful.
Let's say he would have been more proficient on drums or guitar or bass or whatever, as opposed to the French horn and the banjo and things like that. Like you mentioned the Bach concerto and all that. In the pop zone, if you will, the pop rock zone, they kind of want certain instruments, you know what I'm saying? They don't really go in for the banjo necessarily right off the bat, but Pete's always been very experimental, and Mike was as well in his own way, and you know, so I just wonder if that had anything to do with him not being as accepted as a musician, you think?
He was definitely more of a folky. He was in Greenwich Village, and folky stuff kind of gave way to rock and roll. And I think you could be right that the sound that was favored was not the sound that he really was more known for. Mike kind of fused country and rock together in this really awesome way, and he was able to get kind of the approval from the rock world in certain ways because he did that. But like Peter, you know, Peter kind of, I think, was more of a purist, and he was more in the folky tradition. In the 70s, I believe it was, Peter performed at CBGB uh-huh. in New York City. Now, that is a punk
mecca,
exactly. And he gets up there and he's doing folky stuff. I mean, that's wonderful. I'm sure, I think he was fairly well received from what I remember reading. You know, it's such a different thing than what you would expect at a place like that. But he brought that there. He brought that, that's his style. That's what he was being true to.
When Peter Tork was a member of the iconic 60s rock band The Monkees, he always wanted to be respected as a serious musician. Well, today he's still playing and having more fun than more fun than ever the second time around. Here's John Crane.
It ain't your fault, baby.
Peter
Torque is finding happiness in the blues.
Go ahead and do what you gotta do.
He survived adversity and has reinvented himself. When not touring with his band Shoe Suede Blues, Peter can be found hanging out with his friends and living the life of a country gentleman on his family's farm in northeastern Connecticut. Each day begins with yoga to stay fit, reflect, and gain perspective on his life and music.
For years, I thought I was just going with the flow, man. It's just like, this is what it was cool, you know? And recently, I've come to see that this has always been my choice. This is what I wanted to do.
Hey, hey, with the Monkees!
Torque and the Monkees burst onto the scene in 1966, a made-for-TV phenomenon that produced four chart-topping albums in 12 months. But the height of Monkees madness lasted a brief 2 years, and Peter Torque helped end it.
I quit because I wanted to do music. I thought music was the thing. I wanted the Monkees to do the music. It was what I wanted. It wasn't what they wanted.
Torque, born Peter Thorkelson, had been a serious musician since childhood. After dropping out of college, Peter migrated to the Greenwich Village folk music scene, hanging out with the likes of Stephen Stills and playing for Coin. They moved on to California, where Stills suggested Torque audition for the Monkees.
When this whole thing started to happen, my grandmother started running up and getting all the teen magazines, Tiger Beat, Monkey Spectaculars, 16 magazines. Ooh, and Hullabaloo says Peter steals the show.
But he didn't steal any shows on his own, forming a couple of bands and leading a quiet but troubled life. By the 1970s, Torque was struggling with drugs, booze, and money. For a while, he taught school, and then he was once again forced back into the streets playing music for coins.
Sometimes I see my life as a, you know, there's this boom, and then rebounding, where that bottom is the last moment where alcoholism was having its way with me, just at that turning point where I suddenly went, wait a minute, I can't do this. This is, you know, and scurried around looking for help and found the help I needed and haven't had to drink since then. It's been 29 years. Haven't had to drink, haven't had to smoke a stick of dope or do a line or anything else.
Oh, when I woke up one morning, the air was black as ink.
Playing the blues has helped Torque stay true to himself.
A lot of middle American culture is about, don't be down. If you think you're down, you will be down. Don't be down. Don't think you're down, because then you'll be fine. If you're, you'll be fine. Like this, you know, crazed need to shove away life.
I was looking at my future. Man, and it looks scary.
The point of the blues is we've all had the blues. The blues is saying you're not alone. You feeling down? That's life. It's okay. I've been down too.
Adversity revisited Torque when he was diagnosed with a rare form of tongue cancer.
When I got the diagnosis, I had a good cry. You know, I'm not immune. But then the next question is, what's next?
You want me to sign this to you?
Now cancer-free, Torque hit the road, with fans of all ages lining up once more. Some get emotional, meeting the famous former Monkey.
You have no idea.
Yes, I do.
You were my first concert when I was 16.
Really? Yeah. Fabulous.
This was my 14th birthday present from my mother. I listened to them starting in middle school, I think. Used to do the Monkees walk down the street with my friends. I taught my friends how to walk like the Monkees.
No, not that. Just like this. Boom, boom.
Torque isn't beyond teaching the Monkey walk either.
Just go ahead. Left, step to the right. Right. Oh, now okay. Sweep left.
Okay.
It looks better when you've got three or four guys doing it.
Keep going, keep going.
That's kind of how it's working out.
This is like my dream come true, to be doing the Monkey walk with Peter Torque.
Oh, mine too. Teaching somebody how to do the Monkey walk 40 years later.
But you won't see any Monkees memorabilia on display at his home. The gold and platinum records are hidden away in a closet.
I thought I was going to write the book, The Monkees on My Back. And of course, the joke is I'll always have the Monkees on my back.
He refers to the rap that, for many, the Monkees were a commercial imitation of a real band.
Let them think what they think. Nobody doesn't get stereotyped. Nobody doesn't get scorned. Everybody's bad news in somebody's life. I used to cleave. No. Listen, you don't understand. I'm really worth something. I've got talent. I'm really... No more.
Well, one of the things about Peter that very few people know, unless you're a real ardent, diehard Monkey fan, is Peter was by far the most accomplished musician of all of us. In fact, Peter plays like 5 instruments. He plays anything. You just sit him in a room with a bunch of instruments and he will pick up anything and play it. It's amazing.
Music is Peter Tork's life. In spite of it all, he has persevered.
The thing that is most important to me is that I haven't given up, haven't quit. I haven't quit doing the music. I haven't quit doing the what we call the exploration of the mystery. I haven't quit trying to grow up, be as real as I can with my loved ones. You know, those, I haven't quit. And I expect not to.
One thing that I feel that you get from Peter Tork is that even when he's joking around or even when he's talking serious, that he's coming straight from his heart. Like, I really see a lot of his heart in every time he speaks or even when he plays. You really get that feeling. I think that if more people were open to it, that they'd realize just how gifted Peter Tork is.
Oh, I agree. I mean, he's all about the music. He lives and he breathes the music. Like when you watch him play, he kind of loses himself in the music. He has what I call a concentration face. Uh-huh. And it's the same face that he has had since the 60s, where he is, you know, the way he looks at the banjo or the guitar or the keys, like he's just so into it. And that's where he lives. And that's where his heart is. And I agree. Peter's a lovely guy, but sometimes it may not be so easy to relate to him on certain levels, but if you look at the music, that's where his heart is. That's where you can see it.
It always blew my mind when you find out that Peter actually bought himself out of the Monkees after the 33 and a third Revolution special. Mm-hmm. This is about Peter Tork no longer getting the group dynamic he wanted and pleading exhaustion from the grueling schedule that they were on. Tork bought out the remaining 4 years of his contract after filming was complete on December 20th, 1968, at a default of $150,000 per year. This was mentioned in the DVD commentary for the 33 and a third Revolutions per Monkey TV special, mm-hmm. which was originally broadcast April 14th, 1969. Mickey Dolenz noted that Nesmith gave Tork a gold watch as a going-away present engraved from the guys at work. Tork kept the back, but replaced the watch several times in later years. During a trip to London in December of 1967, Peter contributed banjo to George Harrison's soundtrack to the 1968 film Wonderwall. So that's pretty cool. His playing is featured in the movie, but not on the official Wonderwall music soundtrack album released in 68. So that's pretty amazing. A lot of people don't realize that.
This is a song that you might know if you're about as old as, probably as old as your grandmother, really. But this is an old song. I'm going to do it a little bit different. I was thinking about this earlier. So. Well, I thought love was only true in the fairy tale. Meant for someone else, but not for me. Love was out to get me. That's the way it seemed. Disappointment haunted all my dreams. Then I saw her face. Now I'm a believer, not a trace of doubt in my mind. I'm in love. I'm a believer. I couldn't leave her if I tried. Well, I thought love was more or less a given thing. Seems the more I gave, the less I got. What's the use in trying? All you get is pain. When I needed sunshine, I got rain. Then I saw her face. Now I'm a believer, not a tray. Doubt in my mind, I'm in love. I'm a believer, I couldn't leave her if I tried. Disappointment haunted all my dreams. Then I saw her face. Now I'm a believer, not a trace of doubt in my mind. I'm in the love. I'm a believer. I couldn't leave her if I tried. Yeah, it's the old songs that get them every time.
I think Peter Tork will surprise you if you check out his music and a lot of his thoughts. And I, of course, we all love his humor. What did you love most about his time on the TV show as a monkey?
Well, on the show, you know, he's just absolutely adorable. He's kind of hapless, and he gets into these situations that the other three have to rescue him from. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of funny because you don't realize that he's the oldest monkey, because he certainly doesn't seem like it on the show. You know, I know they fudged the birth dates in the beginning. They fudged it to make him younger rather than because Mike was supposed to be the leader. So they wanted him to appear to be the oldest. Mm-hmm. So they changed Peter's birth date to 1944 when it's actually 1942. But he became my favorite very quickly on the show. LaDavie was my first favorite, and then Peter became my favorite. He's just so sweet on the show, and dimpled and goofy, and you know, you can't help but love him. I mean, and I love watching him play his bass guitar on the show. He's quite enthusiastic. I've never seen someone quite so enthusiastically playing their bass guitar as Peter does with his hips. It's kind of, the other three are a little more cynical, a little more world weary, and Peter kind of brings the innocence element to the show as the character of Peter Tork, which is just also ironic given his real life proclivities and everything that he was involved with in the 60s, kind of being very dissimilar to the character he played on the show.
You know, basically, I'm a very nonviolent person.
Oh, really? That's very refreshing.
One of my favorite live moments from this last tour is when somebody said this.
I love you too, grateful ticket buyer.
Yeah, that's pretty Peter. Cool. Yep, that's Peter. You know, he's been through a lot in his life, and he's come out healthy and happy, and of course he had a bout with cancer, and thank God that he's still with us, so we want to, you know, just shine a little light on Peter Tork. And by no means is this a complete tribute to Peter Tork or anything. It's just kind of like a audio montage of some things that you may be surprised to hear from Peter Tork, and glad we could share this together.
I'm glad I've been able to go see his show so many times, and that I've had the chance to get to know the members of the band, who are all such lovely people. I'm grateful that I've gotten to talk to Peter and also that I've gotten exposed to so much blues music, which I never otherwise would have been exposed to, like Muddy Waters, Louis Jordan, John Lee Hooker, mm-hmm. all these artists that I would not have had any idea of were it not for Peter. And I'm glad that he has such a love for the blues, and that, you know, he's exposed so many Monkees fans, I think, as well to blues music.
The one thing that has driven me crazy in times is when I, you know, as someone who has done a little bit of announcing in his time, is trying to say Shoe Suede Blues properly. The first time I saw it, it really messed me up. It took me a while to learn how to say that without stammering. But
it's a little tough. Well, Peter always says that once you can say the name of his band, you won't be able to say the name of the Elvis song properly. So
yeah, you almost have to think backwards again. Well, I want to thank you for being part of this focus on Peter Tork.
Well, thank you so much. It was my pleasure. I'm so glad I could come on and talk a little bit about Peter, and it was wonderful getting to do so, and I really appreciate it.
And I hope that if I see you at a convention that you'll bring me cookies, too.
We'll see. We'll see what we can do.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Amy.
Thank you, Ken.
All right. Okay. Well, I guess it's time to wrap it up. So,
bye.
Zilch. Take some time to monkey around. Here we go. Walking down the street. We get the funniest looks from
Isn't that dumb?
And that's our show. Zilch is an online nonprofit monkeys audio fanzine made by fans for fans. Any samples of music or interviews heard remain property of their owners. We are not related to the monkeys or any of their members past or present. We are not affiliated with Rhino or Ray Burke. If you hear anything you like from the band, go on Amazon or iTunes and buy it. If you enjoyed the show, like us on Facebook and rate us on iTunes. Thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm your announcer, Chelsea Epstein, saying always take some time to monkey around.